Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economic ecology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Bryce Hoffman is an author, speaker, and consultant. He wrote about the Ford Motor Company and the auto industry bailout in his book, American Icon, Alan Mulally and the Fight to Save the Ford Motor Company. A.J. Baim is a journalist who wrote Arsenal of Democracy, FDR, Detroit, and an Epic Quest to Arm an America at War. Bryce and A.J. visited Traverse City in 2014 and talked with auto industry writer Gene Jennings on the stage of the City Opera House. Gene asked A.J. to start off the evening talking about his book.
This is The Arsenal of Democracy. It took me 4.5 years to write. It's my third book. If I had to sum it up in a sentence, it's really about how FDR came up with an idea of how to win World War II. We were going to overwhelm the Axis powers with tanks and airplanes. It was going to be a war of production, and about how the automobile industry really played the starring role. And from there, I get into the Ford family and their role and what they did, because it's really the most amazing story during the war, to me at least, out of Detroit. So.
Okay, and then very quickly, Bryce, would you tell us what your book is about?
I would. My book is American Icon, Alan Mulally and the Fight to Save Ford Motor Company. And as Gene said, this is really the recent history of Ford. My book is about how, against the backdrop of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, Ford Motor Company, without taking a government bailout and without going bankrupt, saved itself and became one of the most profitable automakers in the world.
Fantastic. So we have the bookend here. I want to just kind of ask you a few questions about the writing and why did you do this book, AJ? All those people pretty much are dead. Why
it's
did you
the funny
do this?
Thing about history. That happens a lot.
I only knew.
This book sort of began. I was writing this book called Go Like Hell, which came out in 2009, and I had this wealth. I was fascinated with this character, Edsel Ford.
That would be the Edsel Ford the first.
Edsel Ford the first, who is the only son, technically speaking, of Henry Ford. You're from Michigan.
Nice one.
You know the gossip. You're from Michigan. Maybe you know the gossip. I don't know. But he's the only proven son of Henry Ford. So I had all this material about Edsel, and I knew that the character Edsel that everybody thinks about, he's often compared to the car, which came out in 1957 and flopped, and it's pretty much the greatest flop in automotive history, and people think of Edsel Ford and they think of that car. Also, during his life, he was incredibly misunderstood, and I knew him from my research to be an extraordinary hero. And so I was also very interested, and I really wanted to write about Franklin Roosevelt. And I saw that Roosevelt's desire to win, his idea to win the war, and the epic story of Edsel Ford and his father, Henry, and the way those two stories culminate at the exact same time and sort of meet in the middle. When I figured that out, I knew that I had to write it. So it took 4.5 years, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears.
So how many actual Rubbermaid containers do you have, those large ones, of material for this epic story?
Let me put it to you this way. There's 41 pages of endnotes here.
Right.
So every quote, I had to explain where I got it from. And while I was writing the endnotes, it took me months because I had papers and books that could literally fill the stage. I remember I was trying to, because I'm not terribly organized, but I had to find all this material. And there was just so much stuff. I had amassed years of research. And actually, while I was writing the endnotes, I went to the doctor and he took my blood pressure. And he's like, oh, you need to chill out. But it was that hard because there was that much stuff, years of it. And now it's still in my bedroom. I don't know what to do with it.
I have another question, and that is, you know, your book reads like a novel. And, you know, what novelistic devices did you use to write this history book? What devices did you use to make it read like a novel?
Well, there's a couple things I can say about that. One is I'm attracted to novelistic stories, and I'm attracted to writing books that fit into that perfect narrative art. This one specifically, actually the last one too, I was really inspired as a kid by John Dos Passos, who wrote a book called Manhattan Transfer, and he was really the first guy to go out there and really prove how effective it can be to tell numerous stories at once and have them bounce off of each other And that's what's going on here. But I just love narrative arc. I love characters, and I love stories that build and build and build and build, and they make you want to turn the pages.
Mission accomplished, I would say. So thank you. I'm going to ask you the same questions, Bryce. Why did you do... Oh, wait, I have one more. Who was paying while you were doing all that?
I think I might have been the last author to get an advance. I don't know. I mean, I had a full-time job.
You were still
working for a good portion, the whole time, right? There was years of, like, very, very little sleep. When I started the book, I had one kid. When I finished it, I had two. There was just no sleep at all for years. But I will say that... I'm really attracted to books. I think that like narrative nonfiction that can fit into that fictional narrative art, those stories are so hard to find. And when I read Bryce's book, I was like, wow, it's a very similar book in that it builds and builds and builds, and you just can't stop. Even though I write about automobiles and I'm a little bit in the business, I knew the story of American Icon, but I couldn't stop reading because the story's building and just there's more pressure on these characters, and those are the stories that thrill me.
And writing is about the story, it really is. Telling a great story will ensure that success. And Bryce, why did you decide to write American Icon?
So Jean, I was covering Ford as the Ford beat reporter for the Detroit News. I started doing that in 2005, which is really kind of the beginning of the events that I chronicle in American Icon. And I knew from literally my first week on the job that I was witnessing history being made, and I knew I was going to write a book about it. I didn't know how that story was going to end. I didn't know if I was watching the death of an American icon or its resurrection, but I knew that either way it was going to be an amazing story. And so for 5 years, I kept copious notes as part of my day job, you know, chronicling this story and keeping track of the parts of it that couldn't be told in the daily newspaper, if you will. And then I took a year off from the news to write the book, and I thought that it was mostly going to be just about putting those notes together and writing the book. And it took only one interview with Alan Mulally to realize that a huge part of this story had completely been hidden from the press, and that there were some really amazing things that had happened behind the scenes, and that I had a lot more work on my hands than I originally planned. So I originally planned to take 6 months off of my job. I ended up taking a year and really having to rush at that to do that.
Now, you had incredible, unfettered access to Ford Motor Company and all its executives and all the warts, and there were warts. They're like just incredibly warty people there. How did you get that?
So in 2010, after Ford had turned the corner, spoiler alert here, saved itself, I approached Bill Ford, who I'd come to know quite well from having covered the company, and I said, look, I'm going to do a book on this past few years here, this amazing story that you guys have all written. And I said, I'd really like you to cooperate with this. I'd like to have access to you and to all of your executives. I'd like to have access to the company records. I'd like to tell the story, warts and all. And I said, I'm going to do it either way. But I just think that if the whole story is told, it will be so much more powerful. Because, you know, look, I said, you know how it ends. It's going to be a positive story because you guys saved the company. But let me tell the truth. And to his credit, Bill really got that, and he gave me his blessing without any conditions. The only thing that I told Ford was that I would give them a copy a week before it went out to the press so that they could prepare themselves for questions from the media, but that they would have no editorial control, no editorial input into the book. And they gave me everything I needed. I spent the next year, I interviewed over 100 people, mostly Ford executives, labor leaders, factory workers, dealers, had access to the company's war rooms, had access to financial records, and really was able to put together the story of what really happened. And it really was a more amazing story than I even knew.
In the immortal words of Dr. Gregory House, he just plays one on TV or used to, people lie.
Yes, they do. And the beauty of having access to...
You didn't have that problem because yours are all dead.
Yeah, this was...
They still lied. They did.
They still lied.
The people do lie, and the beauty of having access to everybody was that I was able to go to key moments in this turnaround story key moments in the Ford saga and literally speak to every single person who was in the room and say, what really happened? This is what I've heard. Tell me what really happened. And, you know, by the time you've talked to everybody who was, you know, around the table in the meeting or everybody who was, you know, at an offsite or something like that, you really, you know, you do have a sense of who's telling the truth and who's not. And, but that was really the work of researching this book. I didn't have to go through a lot of, I did not have a bedroom full of Tupperware, but what I did do was spend a great deal of time talking to people over and over and calling them back up and saying, look, one more question, and I promise this is the last, even though I told you that three questions ago, you know, when you were talking about, you know, just really minute things, when you were talking about, you know, borrowing $23 billion from the government, did you say...
That was minute. Borrowing $23 billion. Very minute detail, sorry.
No, I would, you know, I'd say, do you recall, did you say that, you know, that we have no choice, or did you say this is a good, you know, I'm just really kind of getting them to think back and put it all together.
Tell everyone about the day you were going to press, the night before you were handing your book off. I love this one.
We were talking with a group of students earlier today about the writing process, and one of them asked about you know, how do you know that you have your facts right? And my answer was that the anxiety of that question kept me up at night to the point that literally the night before I sent my manuscript into the publisher, I bolted upright at like 3 o'clock in the morning, having just thought of one thing I hadn't like triple checked, and like called at 8 in the morning the next morning, called Ford and had them go over it one more time, go over the numbers one more time, because it was this really arcane bit of bond finance that I didn't really understand and wanted to make sure I had right, because I was just so terrified that it might not be.
And?
We fixed it.
There was a small error. There's nothing like fact checkers. God bless all fact checkers.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, A.J. Baim talks more about the Ford Motor Company's role in helping the war effort during World War II.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Gene Jennings' conversation with A.J. Baim and Bryce Hoffman.
Henry Ford, he was a genius. He was a flawed genius. But there's no, I mean, the things I learned about him in your book were amazing. We know that he was anti-Semitic. We know there was some problems with his relationship with the German government at the time. Could you talk a little bit about that? And what we're trying to do here is connect some dots from the beginning to the end and see the things that keep popping up in this long story about America's royalty.
Anybody who's read much about the Ford family and Henry Ford, there's been so many books written like Henry Ford and the Jews, for example, knows that Henry was anti-Semitic, and that during the, I think it was 1919 to 1921, he purchased a weekly newspaper, and there were weekly essays in there that were, when you look at them today, I mean, they're shocking. Jazz, Jewish moron music becomes national music, and there was all of this material in there about what was wrong with the Jews and what, you know, how they were controlling the media and what a bad thing that was. Now, I gave a talk at the 92nd Street Y not so long ago, which is a Jewish organization, and it was very strange to speak about this there because everybody had this very, you know, really strong opinions about Henry Ford and who he was. And one of the things I point out in the book, and that I think is really important, when you're writing history, it's so important to understand the context of these characters and these events and what people are saying and why they were saying that. And anti-Semitism in the 1920s in America, I mean, it was everywhere. It was in the school books that children read, literally. And I think Henry thought that he was really giving a voice to what a lot of people thought, and he was Henry Ford. He was literally, at the time, the most famous man in the world. And so he was, you know, he had the opportunity to deliver this message. Now, the book, the articles got put into a book, and they were translated to many languages around the world. And in the 1920s, this book was read avidly in Germany. And there was a young militant there named Adolf Hitler who picked up the book, and he spoke up about it, and he had a picture of Henry Ford in his office. And Henry Ford was really Adolf Hitler's hero, not just because he thought of Henry Ford as an anti-Semite, but also because he believed that Henry Ford's vision of what Henry Ford had done for the United States of America could be done for Germany. And in fact, that was true, because when Hitler took power, the first thing he did was empower the automobile industry. And so it was pretty shocking to the amazing to think that during the Great Depression, Germany had a labor shortage and that their economy was booming. So, but really an incredibly complex character. Henry Ford was a wonderful character to explore because he had all facets of humanity. I mean, he was a genius and he was at times a great family man. And I did interviews with people who remembered him, and they remembered him extremely fondly, especially because he had a very soft spot for children. And so the people I was able to interview who knew him were very young at the time. Obviously, an extraordinary character to write about. I don't think it's any secret. I mean, to me, the Ford family and the Kennedy family, the most epic stories in those families through the 20th century. It's just, it's hard to believe
they have,
that their stories are true.
Quite a parallel there. The good, the bad, the ugly,
exactly.
All of it. He loved his son Edsel so much, his only son Edsel.
Well, this to me, this book is a lot of things. It functions on many levels, and I really worked hard to make that happen. So it's really a book about World War II and about the FDR administration. But really, when you get down to it, it's about a father and a son and a grandson, Henry Ford II, because Edsel Ford dies during the story in 1943. But I think that they had an extraordinary relationship that I really took home, and I thought so much about me and myself as a father. I have a son and my own father. And these two men, they really butted heads, because Edsel was not the child that Henry wanted him to be, but they loved each other so deeply. And their relationship suffered, but I think they both suffered so deeply.
So you describe what kind of person Edsel was compared to what kind of person Henry was.
Well, Henry was, he was the star of the show, without a doubt. Edsel Ford, I think, is so extremely misunderstood. To me, he was way ahead of his time, extraordinarily sophisticated, and he existed in a world that didn't exist around him yet. And it was only after he was dead that people looked, and only the people really close to him looked around and saw, wow, this guy really knew what was going on. And when you go back and read, he was very press shy, which I think was another problem, because he was, you know, he was the president of Ford Motor Company for more than half of his life. But he hated giving interviews. He hated being the center of attention. I think that was a problem for him.
Do you think that was caused by his father belittling him? I mean, shouting at him in front of all the executives and...
I'll tell you exactly what it would cause. There's a poignant point early in this book where Edsel is born. He's the only child, the richest, most famous man in the world. He loves his father. His father loves him. He has this whole world created for him. And everybody, there were literally people naming their sons Edsel Ford. There was an Edsel Ford born in Michigan, in Indiana, in Louisiana, because he was the child that everybody wanted to be. Now, during World War I, Edsel was forbidden from his father from serving in the military. So at a very tender age, he was brutally maligned in the world's newspapers, brutally. And he realized at the time that it was not going to be as easy as he thought it was to be Edsel Ford.
And somehow he prevailed. There are so many superlatives that I couldn't take them all in. The superlatives that of Ford and Detroit, that you know that Henry Ford was the beginning of the industrial age. That he just talk about just the high points of Henry Ford's life. They're amazing.
They're amazing. I think it's really because of Henry Ford that Americans throughout the world, I mean, the Model T spread the gospel of the new machine age everywhere. Henry really was the reason, I think, that the United States considered itself at the forefront of nations in this new machine age. You can think of what this man did, the Model T, the $5 day, and it would take hours to explain, you know, why the $5 day was so incredibly important. Bryce does a little of that in his book.
It created the middle class. It created the industrial middle class that made America what it is today.
Gave the first generation of black Americans the ability to send that first generation of kids to college, become doctors and lawyers. This is Ford. Ford did that.
There's a scene in this book where Henry takes this guy named, I think his name is William Perry, brings him into the assembly line and goes to a foreman and says, give this man a job. And he was an African-American man, and that had never happened. And everybody, and all of a sudden, there was this huge mass exodus of African-Americans from the South, all coming to Detroit to get a job at Henry Ford's. Ultimately, the superlative.
Your superlatives, the biggest ever.
The superlative that to me really ultimately happens is not Henry's accomplishment. It's Edsel Ford's. As Edsel Ford is dying during World War II, he begins this experiment to try to build the biggest aviation factory in the world to build these bombers for the American military. The biggest, the fastest, and the most destructive bomber in our arsenal at the time, because it was before the B-29. And turn that into the most mass-produced military aircraft, American military aircraft of all time, and it still is. The B-24 Liberator is today the most mass-produced American military aircraft.
In the largest factory in the world, and it's amazing. It's just amazing that he did that in Willow Run, and you know, we'll just kind of skip forward to that time, unless you'd like to talk a little bit about President Roosevelt and his relationship with the family.
Okay. Henry Ford and FDR, they really hated each other. I spent a lot of time going through FDR's files, and I found this handwritten note from FDR to Henry Morgenthau saying, if Henry will just call me on the phone, you know, everything will be okay, we'll get through this. But Henry hated him. And because he was such an iconoclast and such an individualist, he did not take kindly to people like FDR telling him how to run his business. So when the two men actually met, it made the cover of Newsweek. It was 1938, and it showed a piece of paper ripped in half with Henry Ford on one side and Roosevelt on the other. And even after that, they continued. They hated each other even more. But after, this is one thing this book is very much about, is patriotism, because after World War II, they really became allies in the cause.
They pretty much had to. You know, Rosie the Riveter was someone at the Willow Run factory who was working on the Liberators. And it brings up how many women, that's the other thing the Ford Motor Company did, was for the first time really liberate women's from the home and gave them the ability to go to work and have a job and make money and show how good they were at that. But it wasn't just women. At one point, I think 30% of the factory force were women. But he also, as you said, hired a lot of African Americans. He hired dwarves. I thought that was the most amazing. Tell me about that.
Well, during the war, there was such a labor shortage. So they could not get people to run these machines to build this Liberator bomber. So it wasn't just Ford. I mean, the FDR administration and Eleanor Roosevelt was such a force behind this to get women into the factories. And we all know what happened next. But the character of Rosie the Riveter, you know, she was based on this woman named Rose Monroe. She was actually based on a number of different women, but it began with Rose Monroe, who was a riveter at the Willow Run factory. And yes, during the war, they wanted to make use of any labor they could find. So here was a Liberator where they had to have people climb inside a wing and use rivets, so they hired dwarves. They had epileptics, they had blind people. If you could walk, they found you a job. Something that struck me as amazing.
Deaf, blind, legless people, armless people.
Absolutely.
Amazing.
They had people coming there and showing up from the South who had never worn shoes. And they showed up at this factory they wanted to work and they wanted to serve, and mostly they wanted to be able to make money and support themselves. They had never worn shoes in their lives because Ford had said, the labor shortage was so extreme, the Ford Motor Company sent buses sweeping through the South, filled them up with people who had never been out of their hometown, and drove them to Dearborn.
So how was Edsel's relationship with his own sons, Henry Ford II and Benson, who you don't really mention very much, and William Clay?
To me, one of the reasons I loved Edsel as a character is because he cared for his sons so deeply. And his life was extremely stressful, and the weight on him was extreme. And he would come home. I don't know if anybody's ever been to Gawkler Point, this beautiful mansion out there in Grosse Pointe where you can go, and it's a museum now, and it's just an extraordinary place, but it has these huge security gates. And his once he crossed those walls, you know, his life was about being a father. And in the book, Henry Ford II is the one I really bring to life, because he was the one, he was the oldest, and he was the one who was going to have to take over the battle for Edsel, and that's what happened. But one of the, in my research of him, that was one of the things that touched me the most, is how much he cared for his kids, and
he let them go to war. Yeah, he let Henry.
Well,
Ford
he let
go
them in
war.
The military. They never served overseas. But that's also a big scene in the book where he has to confront the idea that his kids are going to join the military and go off, and he had to let them do that because of what had happened to him during World War I.
It's amazing, you know, Edsel was only 5'4", and Henry Ford was almost twice as big as that, at least in our history. I don't mean literally, I mean, he wasn't 10 feet tall, but he was a really tall guy.
He was, like, in terms of what he was in the room, he was 10 feet tall.
He was.
And I think Edsel sighed, he was diminutive in many ways, but he, as an executive, I just think he was really much more than that.
So what do you think, how did Henry Ford die? How what was he like when he died? Was he a bitter man? Was he, you know, we were pretty sure he had dementia pretty much by then.
I think by the time the war came, he was not all there. And I don't know if he was a bitter man. It's hard to say. But I know that when his son died, he was in a position to really look at himself in a different way. Maybe I'll read it later, but he actually wrote a poem about his son called What is a Boy? It's so moving. But he still couldn't understand. When you read the dialogue, he has this crony named Harry Bennett. Maybe somebody knows, you know, people in Michigan might know who Harry Bennett is. He was this gangster, and it was Henry Ford's best friend. And he, you know, he went to Harry Bennett when Edsel died, and he's like, Harry, was I mean to Edsel? Was I unfair to Edsel? You know, he still didn't understand. He couldn't get it.
You know, we know about Harry Bennett just peripherally that he was he was a thug, he was his henchman, and he brought in a lot of people as a security force and was part of the Battle of the Overpass where they were up against the Union. But it was way worse than I ever thought or knew. He had 1,000 thugs working for him, mafiosi thugs.
Harry Bennett was this character who Henry Ford hired to police his factories. And Harry Bennett built something called the Service Department, which was at the time the largest private police force in the world. It was made up of these thugs, literally ex-boxers. He would hire, after the University of Michigan class, the football team, after they graduated, he would just hire the whole football team and bring them in and have them beat up people. And there are these amazing oral histories.
Amazing.
If anybody ever wants, go to the Benson Ford Research Center. Anybody here, in fact, some of them are up or online now. You can read these oral histories of people who worked there at the time describing these events and these people, and they're just extraordinary. And again, back to what we were talking about, what is a fact and what isn't? You read these oral histories, and they all talk about Harry Bennett because he was so powerful. I mean, he was the second most powerful. He was more powerful than Edsel. In fact, the first line in Harry Bennett's memoir is, I was Henry Ford's closest confidant, closer to him even than his only son. And to write about this character, I mean, he was a gangster. He was a killer.
Really amazing. And how did he go down in flames?
One of the reasons I knew I wanted to write this book is because there's this whole thing of good and evil in this book. It's within the Ford family. To me, it's very Shakespearean. And good wins in the end, as we want it to. That's what makes a good book. But what struck me is that there was this power struggle of good and evil inside the Ford Empire. And that power struggle, good defeated evil, and that happened at the exact same time of D-Day as Ford was building, you know, becoming this important thing in FDR's arsenal of democracy. So you could tell the stories at the same time, which was just what this
spectacular.
Book.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Bryce Hoffman talks about how the Ford Motor Company's president surprised everyone during the 2008 auto industry crisis.
listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Gene Jennings talking with Bryce Hoffman about his book, American Icon, Alan Mulally, and the Fight to Save the Ford Motor Company.
I think we're gonna jump ahead now to Bryce, where all the people are alive, and how in God's name did you get that access again? What? How did you get access in there? I can't believe that they let you in, because the thing that starts in the past that carried through to when you were a journalist, you can correct me with if I'm wrong, of course I'm not, there were about a half a dozen top executives at Ford, and they were, I described them as the Medicis meet the Machiavellis or the Borgias, really. This culture went all the way back. Then this top level of people that Henry Ford had no control over Harry Bennett. Nobody had control over him. And nobody could stop these Ford executives in my day from just stabbing each other in the back at any chance to kill or be killed, eat or be eaten. We had guys from America hiding in Europe, guys from Europe hiding in America. All of them just, you know, they'd take each other out. Did you notice that?
I did, Gene. Now that you mention it.
Yeah. Forgotten that, right?
No, it's true. And Ford really, you know, as I put it in my book, these were really birth defects that go back to the company's founding with Henry Ford. If you look at, there's some really big points that begin all the way back there that continued to the present day that really kept the company from solving its own problems and getting out of its own way. One was the over-reliance on one leader. You know, first it was Henry Ford, then it was Hank the Deuce. You know, at different points it was different people. But there was never a culture of building a team at the top of the company. It was always one man, you know, who by the force of his will.
And name on the building.
Yes, was getting things done. There was an over-reliance on one product. You know, in the beginning it was the Model T, then it was the Model A. You know, ultimately it would become other cars, but the company never really diversified its product lineup the way that General Motors or Chrysler did. You know, there was always this dark and sinister side of the company, you know, that started with Harry Bennett, but continued right up until today, you know, to the modern times before Alan Mulally was hired. Bill Ford, you know, talks openly about the fact that when he was CEO of the company, his car was bugged. And, you know, by other Ford executives who were trying to figure out what was going on.
And didn't Harry Bennett have Edsel Ford the first, his office bugged by
his
own people?
Yeah, I mean, the same things happened over and over again. And nobody could kind of crack through this. People tried, you know, when Henry Ford II came in, he tried to make Ford a modern company, but he ultimately succumbed to the same culture that his grandfather had created. And, you know, fast forward to 2001, when Bill Ford Jr., Henry Ford's great-grandson, famously ousted Jack Nasser and took control of the company, which was being run into the ground by Jack.
So let me just interrupt you right there and say, so it was Henry Ford I, Edsel Ford, Henry Ford II, Billy. What happened to Edsel Ford? Edsel Ford was working for the company in Australia. He was in marketing, very successful. He was deeply ingrained. And Billy, in my estimation, was running he's on the board of the Nature Conservancy. He was building fly rods. And he was like in the papers every day, shown training with the lions. And all I could think of was, would you want somebody managing the lions managing your car company? I think not. So what did you encounter? I mean, talk about that. Why Billy and not Edsel?
Well, I didn't really get into that much. I mean, you know, the...
But you know.
The Ford family has always tried to present a united front to the world. And they have always, in each generation, picked one person to kind of be the public face for the family. And there was a time when it was very much up into the air whether that was going to be Edsel II or Bill Ford Jr. And in the end, Bill Ford became the.
They have votes, don't they?
They do. They have family
meetings.
They're
probably not equal.
They have a family meeting, usually four times a year, and you know, Bill was selected to be this generation's leader, and he came on as chairman. They knew he didn't have a lot of business experience, So they thought, well, the solution is we'll pair him with someone who does have a lot of business experience. They found Jack Nasser. And Jack was this really rising star, very tough as nails executive in Ford Motor Company. They thought, we'll make Jack CEO and Bill chairman. Well, you know, this was right before the end of the 1990s, and the way that I think it characterize it is Jack Nasser came in, opened the hood, and looked at what was going on inside the engine that was Ford Motor Company, slammed it shut, and decided to go and invest in dot-coms and technology
Jaguar
companies.
And Aston. And
yeah. I mean, he did not know how to fix Ford, and so rather than trying to fix Ford, he went off and did all of these other things, and in the process really alienated Ford's dealers, Ford's suppliers, Ford's employees. And the company, journalist like Gene, and
not me. I was a sucker.
And was really running the company into the ground. And Bill, you know, to his credit, you know, said, "I'm not going to sit by and watch my family's legacy, you know, torn up by this guy." And he led a boardroom coup that ousted Nasser. Then he tried to tackle these same problems. And he did not have much better luck than Jack had had. He tried to get the company to build, you know, green cars and hybrids because he wasn't an environmentalist, but, you know, they were making all of their money off of big trucks and SUVs, so they kind of said, "That's nice, Bill, you know. We'll talk about that later." And no one would give him a straight answer. And, you know, fast forward to 2006, people didn't know it at the time, but Ford was running out of money to the point that very secretly, at the insistence of the board, they had set up a board-level committee to look at what worst-case scenario options. They were looking at parting the company out to private equity firms, and they were looking at bankruptcy. And while this was happening, Bill was desperately trying to recruit one of the rock stars of the automobile industry to lead his company. First, he went after Carlos Ghosn, who was the CEO of not just Nissan, but also Francis Renault at the same time. He thought he could handle a third company, maybe. He wanted nothing to do with it. He said, "I will come to work for Ford if the Ford family gives up control of the company." He went after Dieter Zetsche, Dr. Z. Remember Dr. Z, who was running Chrysler for Mercedes and starring in their commercials with his white mustache. And same thing, he said, nine. He went after Wolfgang Bernhard, who was about to become the head of Volkswagen. Same thing, he turned him down. And he literally had gone down the list of people that could help him save his company, and they had all turned him down.
Thank goodness.
thank goodness, because then came the real epiphany, which was to bring someone from outside of the automobile
industry. And not just outside of the automobile industry, outside the insulated enclaves where the automotive executives lived. So, we know where the General Motors people live. They live in Bloomfield Hills, and then they live in Naples, and a lot of those people live in Naples, and Hilton Head, mostly Hilton Head. And they would only be with each other, drink with each other, party with each other, know each other's children, go to the same schools. They weren't even diversifying where they lived except for Lutz.
Yeah, so Bill's board, the Ford board, recommends this guy, Alan Mulally, who no one had heard of outside of the kind of upper echelons of American business, but people in that world had heard a lot of him because he was the president of Boeing's commercial aviation group, and he was already being credited with saving Boeing, another iconic American company, from not just one near-death experience, but two. Boeing, when he took over as head of their commercial aviation division, was you know, losing a decades-long fight with Airbus, and that no one thought it could win. He turned things around, got Airbus against the ropes, and then when that happened, 9/11 happened, and all of the world's airlines basically canceled their orders for new planes within 24 hours, and Boeing's order book was like gone overnight. Everyone thought, "Oh my gosh, you know what? Nothing can be done to save Boeing." Alan led this amazing restructuring of Boeing, got huge concessions from their unions, and managed to keep Boeing in the air and also make it profitable again. So the Ford board and Bill said, "Well, here is a guy who has been through the fire, who has done it, who has turned around a failing company, and has done it successfully." He called Alan. He had Alan flown to his house in Ann Arbor. And the two of them sat together one-on-one and had a really frank conversation. And during that conversation, Bill told Alan about Ford's culture. He told him about the history stretching back, you know, to his great-grandfather. And he told him about all of the things that he had tried to do to break through this just ossified corporate culture and how he hadn't been able to do it. And he said, you know, I want you to know what you're getting into. And amazingly enough, after all of that, Alan Mulally still agreed to take the job.
They didn't give Alan Mulally the top job at Boeing when it came loose. So that was Ford's gain.
I'm sure
that had some bearing on that at the time.
Yeah, Boeing had been in the midst of Boeing has two sides to Boeing. There's the commercial aviation side of the Boeing, and there's the military side of Boeing, as Alan likes to put it, the guys who can kill you in the dark with a knife.
That's just like Ford executives at the time.
So he felt right at home.
Amazing, the parallels continue.
And that side of Boeing had been in the midst of a very high-profile scandal with the Pentagon. And the Pentagon, not being particularly creative, their solution was, the only way we can keep working with you is if you find a CEO who has never worked for your company before. And so Alan, So most people thought that Alan had earned the right to become CEO, and instead he was passed over. To the point, by the way, that when he was hired in the fall of 2006, one of my first calls was to the head of the machinist union, which was Boeing's biggest union, and I wanted to get their take on this new guy who was going to be running Ford. And the head of the machinist union starts telling me, "Oh my gosh, he came at us with a bloody axe. This bastard, he cut. There's nothing left of us." And he's going and he's getting all worked up. And he's like, "And it's a damn shame they passed him over for CEO. That is a crime. That is a crime." And yeah. I went, wait. What did I just miss here? Wait, the bloody axe, the bastard, and now wait. And he said, "Well, none of my members would have had any jobs right now if it wasn't for Alan." So you know, that's the type of guy he was, and that's the type of guy he is.
I always thought of him as a smiley freight train from Kansas, because you know, that's how his presentation to everyone, including all his executives.
And he used that to his advantage too. You know, I mean, one of my favorite stories that I learned when I was working on this book was his first meeting with Rick Wagner.
That's a beautiful story.
So
special.
You know, I refer to Alan as a latter day Richie Cunningham. He looks not dissimilar. And has the same kind of aw shucks grin all the time on his face. And, you know, people were making a lot of jokes at his expense right off the bat. You know, like, Ford has hired this aerospace engineer to lead their company?
Yeah, what does a guy who builds airplanes know about building a car? There are a lot of parts in a car.
You know, people at GM in particular were...
Screw up an airplane, right? That was the first question I got asked on television, like the morning later, and I went, "Are you serious? Really?"
Yeah, and people at GM were like, you know, "What is Ford's secret plan? Are they going to finally build flying cars to save the company? You know, are they going to bring back tail fins
Let's
and
go
stuff?"
Play
and
golf.
So, yeah, exactly.
Let's go have martinis.
So Alan, you know, Alan's laughing along with them, you know, because the joke's on them, right? And he called, you know, Rick Wagner calls to introduce himself, and Alan says, "You know, oh wow, Mr. Wagner, head of GM. Boy, I'd sure appreciate it if I could come over and meet you, because I don't know anything about the automobile industry, as y'all pointing out. And I'd love to hear from you all about this wonderful industry that I know nothing about." And so Rick was like, "Oh, of course, please come down to the Rensen and I will be happy to instruct you." And by the time Alan left, he had half of GM's product plan.
Unbelievable. And that's what it took.
And that's Alan. You know, Alan is the proverbial iron fist in the velvet glove. You know, he never stopped smiling, but it was to your peril to think that he was this farm boy from Kansas.
But it wasn't ever a knife in the back with him.
No.
Everything was up front.
Everything
How did
was
he get front? Rid of some of those people? The system he installed to make it safe for them, because this is pretty funny, and it deals with someone who was, we all in the press knew he was going to be out that door in a second. Would you
sure.
talk about that?
Yeah, so the way that Alan made everyone work well and play well together was with a management system that he had developed at Boeing. And it's a really simple system. You instead of getting bogged down and blaming each other for who's responsible for the company's problems and never getting anything done, that everyone on his senior leadership team every week would come together for 2 hours. They'd each have 5 minutes to go over, set a slide showing their part of the company, how it was doing against the plan, and everything would be either red if there was a problem, yellow if there was a concern, or green if it was on plan. He explained this to them. He gave them some sample slides from Boeing. He said, this is how we're going to run forward. The next week, they all came to the first meeting. They all went through their slides, and everything was green. So Alan said, well, maybe I didn't explain it well enough. So he said, let's do this again. So green means everything's OK. Yellow means you have a concern. And red means there's a problem. Next week, everything was still green. Alan said, OK, maybe I'll speak slowly this time. He explained it again. The next week, everything was still green. He just stopped the meeting. He said, guys, we're about to lose $12.5 billion. Is there nothing that is not going right at this company? Or is this the plan? Is this green? Are we planning on going out of business? And he was just met with silence, because at the old Ford, you would never be honest. You would never admit that you had a problem. And so Mark Fields, who is then the president of Ford's Americas Group, who, as Gene points out, was, you know, pretty much thought he was going to be fired anyways, and most people did too, since he was viewed as next in line for CEO. He said, you know what, I'm going to go out in a blaze of glory. And I'm going to go out as the guy who calls this guy's bluff, because nobody believed Alan really meant it. So he knew there was a problem. He knew there was a problem with the launch of the Ford Edge, which was about to be introduced to the market, very important new vehicle for the company. And so he changed his slides. And the next week, he got up and he said, as you can all see right here, the Ford Edge is red. The whole room was dead silent. And I talked to everybody, every single man and woman who was around that table, and they all told me the same thing. I was sure that Mark Fields had just fired himself from Ford Motor Company. But instead, Alan started clapping. He's like, this is great, Mark. Wow, this is great visibility. Who can help Mark with this issue? And then, of course, they all started tripping over each other to offer their assistance. The head of purchasing said, well, let me call the supplier of the assembly, components that are, and everyone was trying to outdo each other and offering their help to Mark rather than stabbing a knife in his back. And when they saw that Mark didn't lose his job because of that, then, as Alan put it to me, he said, Bryce, it was like a beautiful rainbow. And that was the moment, as distressing as it was, when another executive who was there told me, he says, there was so much red on that, it looked like a CSI episode. He said, I thought I stumbled into a murder scene. But Alan said, that was the moment I knew I could save the company. Because I finally had it all out on the table. They were finally telling me what they had never for decades said, which was what the problems were. And once they were out on the table for everyone to see, then we could just get to the business of fixing them.
They mortgaged the whole company. How did that happen? How did they make it through to the point where they didn't take the money? And even my old aunts who lived down south knew within days that they didn't take the money. And I think one of the things that saved him, but going to Congress, what was that all about? How did they make it through?
To me, this is one of the most heroic moments in the history of American business, because, cast yourself at this point, it's 2008, that the banking crisis has happened, the housing crisis has happened, and in the midst of this, Ford and the other three automakers go to Washington and ask for a bailout, and you all remember what happened, right, when they flew on their corporate jets to ask for a bailout? It didn't go well.
The GM PR guy begged Rick Wagner not to do it.
So on the way back on his corporate jet from this trip, Alan Mulally, was really upset. He told me this was the worst day of my life. But it wasn't the worst day of his life because the men and women of Congress had been, sitting up there pounding the big three for all of their decades-long mistakes. He said he got that. What really upset him was that at this point, Ford was 2 years into its turnaround, and before the bottom fell out of the market, it was back, it was making money again, everything was going great. And he said, Bryce, I felt like the only sober guy in a group of drunks, and everyone thought I was an alcoholic. And it just really bothered him that most people looked at all three companies as just Detroit, one giant stumbling dinosaur that couldn't, you know, save itself. So he said, I need to do something to show people we're different. And the next day he had one of his meetings and he had his executive team there and he said, look, I want you all to think about this before you answer. What if we didn't take the bailout? What if we told the American people, thank you, we appreciate it, but we got this. We're gonna fix our problems ourselves. We know we made mistakes. We know how to solve them, and we're gonna do it. Everyone who was at that meeting told me that their first reaction was, okay, the boss has gone crazy. Because Uncle Sam had his checkbook open, and all he wanted to know was how many zeros to write. And they knew that once that checkbook closed, it was never gonna be opened again. And at this point, Ford knew that it had enough money to last 5 months. That in 5 months, the company was gonna be out of cash. And so with that knowledge, with that certain knowledge that they had 5 months cash left, they decided to not take the bailout. But Alan was right. Like Gene said, within 1 week of Ford withdrawing its request for a bailout, 98.5% of the people in the United States of America knew that Ford had done this. And Ford's favorable rating amongst consumers swung to its highest level in the past 50 years. And people started buying Fords again too, even though they weren't really in a buying mood. And they made it through until the market turned. And they ultimately, within 2 years after having been on the verge of bankruptcy, became one of the most profitable automakers in the world.
God bless Alan Mulally. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Good stuff. Thank you.
That was A.J. Baim and Bryce Hoffman talking with Gene Jennings. A.J. Baim wrote Arsenal of Democracy, FDR, Detroit, and an Epic Quest to Arm an America at War. His latest book is The Accidental President, Harry S. Truman and the 4 Months That Changed the World. Bryce Hoffman wrote American Icon, Alan Mulally and the Fight to Save Ford Motor Company. His most recent book is called Red Teaming, How Your Business Can Conquer the Competition by Challenging Everything. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economic ecology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melcarrick.